Is the 30th of April, the year 2004. I'm here in the Ellis Island Oral History Studio with Heidi Wallenfels Shirley, who is the niece of the man that we're going to be speaking about, who is Frederick Ernst O'Hagan, who was interned here at Ellis Island in and around World War II. And we also have Marguerite O'Hagan Monod Kelly with us, who is also a niece of Frederick Ernst O'Hagan. He probably came to this country in about 1924 from Germany and was picked up in California in 1940 and was interned as an enemy alien. He was in other camps before coming to Ellis Island, and we suspect for repatriation. And he was here from whenever he arrived until 1947, so he was here a good long time. And Heidi's mother intervened to try to get him better treatment before he arrived here in the camps that he was in. And apparently he was in solitary confinement for some reason before that. Okay, this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and we're just going to kind of unroll the story as it comes. Okay, if you would say, please, for the tape, Heidi, your birth date.
My birth date is August 31, 1937.
And do you know the birth date of your uncle?
I do. He was born on Christmas, December 24th, 1899.
Okay. And do you know about his life prior to 1940, just here in this country, what kinds of things he was involved with? And
I know some things about it. He, as I say, came over sometime in the early 20s, probably around 24, and he had already had a fairly extensive education in Germany and had gone to a school of mining and gotten an advanced degree there, but didn't ever intend to go into this field. When he first came here, I think his first job was tutoring children in various languages. He had had a classical education in Germany, so he knew Latin and Greek. And I remember that he told me that he was supposed to tutor these children also in Spanish. And he didn't know any Spanish, but in order to get the job, he told the father or the parents of the children that he knew Spanish, and then he managed to stay just ahead of them by reading a chapter or two ahead before he had to give them their lessons. And so I know that he had at least one significant tutoring job. It may be that he had more. My father came over, I think, in 1926 from Germany to the United States, and met my uncle,
his
Friedrich.
Brother.
Right? No. This was
it's your mother.
My father.
Oh, okay.
So this Friedrich O'Hagan was my mother's brother. This is how my parents met, actually. At the time when my father met my uncle Fried, we called him Uncle Fried, he was working in a bank in New York. I'm not sure which one. It was some kind of a mercantile bank, and they had a translation department because they had a lot of export-import business. They did a lot of business with various European countries, and so he had a job there essentially as a translator in the bank where he translated letters from German, French, various languages into English for the bank. And so that's where my father met him. So I know he had that job. How long he had that job, I'm not sure. He later went into the more academic work And I don't know exactly how he did that. But in this article that I mentioned to you that was in the New York Times on March 11th, 1941, it says, it refers to him as Alhagen, a former language professor at Columbia University. So I know at some point he taught, I believe, classical languages, Latin and or Greek at Columbia. Well, it may have been in Columbia Extension. I don't know. But that's what he did. And then during that time, he was probably interested in politics and international relations and was active probably in German groups in New York. And he wrote articles for the American Mercury magazine, which was H.L. Mencken's magazine that was very popular at that time. Mencken was a very well-known writer and speaker. And he also, as I told you before, he took part in debates that were broadcast over the radio. So he became a fairly well-known personage, which is why when his wife divorced him, it made the New York Times.
And she divorced him after he had been incarcerated.
That's right. So this was March 11th, 1941. Apparently she went to Las Vegas and got a divorce on the grounds of staying away from home for long periods without explaining his activities. Well, of course, he was interned, so I don't know if that's what she meant, but probably. And in this article, it says, do you want me just to read
the
first?
Go ahead.
It's from Las Vegas. The headline says, "Divorce to Mrs. Alhagen, wife of man indicted here as Nazi agent gets decree." He wasn't a Nazi agent, but that's in 1941. That's what they thought. And the article says, "Mrs. Irmgard Alhagen obtained a divorce today from Friedrich E. Alhagen, who is under indictment in New York for failure to register as an alien agent." So, because he had been involved in a lot of public activities, speaking and writing, and I believe that his position generally, there was a lot of controversy in this country over whether we should get involved in World War II or not. There was always a significant group that was more isolationist and said, no, that's a European affair, we should stay out of that. And just as there was with World War I. And so he represented the side that urged the American government not to get involved in World War II, to stay out of it. And so that's why he was then also considered an alien agent, I guess, because people felt that he was working for the German government, trying to keep the American army out of World War II.
Yeah. Do you know anything else about his stands as far as Germany or as far as this country, any other his politics? Are you aware of any other besides that, which is very significant?
Well, we have, actually, my cousin has a copy of an article which mentions a debate. We didn't bring that with us, did we? No. Mentions a debate that he took part in with Dorothy Thompson, who was a famous person in those days. I don't know if you are familiar with her. She was a journalist and wrote in a lot of, I think she was a syndicated columnist. She was part of that Algonquin round table, I think. And she was also married to Sinclair Lewis, I think. I mean, you know, so she was a person in the 30s and 40s who was extremely well known. Everybody knew who she was, read her columns, and she did lecture tours all around the country. And this article that we unfortunately didn't bring with us mentions a debate where Dorothy Thompson took the side of pro-entering World War II, I believe, and he took the other side. So that was sort of mainly his position. And he generally, I think, wanted to, you might call him a sort of a PR person for German culture, German things in this country. And I have not read personally these articles that I know that he did write and that were published, so I can't tell you in greater detail. But
as far as you know, he wanted to stay in this country, but he was very fond of the cultural German aspects that he could.
And he felt that Germany was misunderstood, or many people didn't know about it, and so, but he definitely wanted to stay in this country. I mean, he had been here a long time already, obviously, close to 20 years by the time he was arrested. And he had intended to become a citizen, but, people tended to just, they were so busy doing whatever they were
living
doing
life,
that they didn't bother to,
they
didn't bother to apply for citizenship. And I know that he later told me even that that was a big mistake that he had made, ignoring this issue and not having become a citizen.
Right. So maybe you could say something about what you know about his incarceration prior to his coming to Ellis Island.
All right. Well, there's something in this article, too, which says he was arrested in Wilmington. And then it says, at New York, Dyes Committee investigators. And the Dyes Committee was a federal, I'm not sure if it was under the aegis of the Justice Department. It's possible. Some federal government. Or it may have been a subcommittee of Congress. A little bit like the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 50s. The Dyes Committee pursued and really persecuted people who they felt were not sufficiently patriotic, in their opinion. And it says here, Dyes Committee investigators said that Alhagen had been ordered to appear before the committee to answer questions concerning reported plans to organize an American Nazi movement. So that's apparently what they accused him of. But that was not, in fact, his intention or what he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so for this, he was put into solitary and treated badly.
I'm not sure of the chronological progression of what happened to him after he was arrested. We do know now, based on this letter, that he did spend time in this other fort, Fort Abraham Lincoln, which I believe, as I said, is in the Dakotas somewhere. And I know that he did have a trial of some kind that took place in the Washington, D.C. area in a federal court. And I believe my mother even wrote a letter to Justice Frankfurter trying to get him to intercede in this case because she felt so strongly that her brother had been unjustly accused and that the trial had been a, kind of a sham trial, where he was railroaded. And he was not permitted to have a lawyer. And, maybe he was treated like Mr. Padilla is being treated now, an enemy combatant, and therefore he was not permitted any access to any papers or any evidence that would have helped him prove that he was not, in fact, what they claimed he was, and not given an opportunity to consult a lawyer or have any witnesses on his behalf. I mean, it was, you know, it was really not, he was not given due process.
Right.
I guess that's,
right.
that's what you would call it now. And I know the family story that I got, and I don't know whether this is really true. I'll have to check with his, perhaps his sons in Germany know better, was that when he was, after he was deported and sent back to Germany in 1947, he was tried, and I don't know if it was an adjunct of the Nuremberg trials, but that he underwent another trial, and it may have been that it was part of the Nuremberg trials where they tried everybody that they thought had any Nazi connections, and that he was acquitted at that time, and that they apologized. I think they apologized, or they said, we now see that we did not have sufficient evidence to charge you with the things that you were charged, and we're sorry that we took, you know,
seven years of your life away
and deprived you of your liberty for all of that time.
So, now, did he stay in Germany then, or did he return
to
the U.S.?
No, I don't think, I think at first they would not, even though they did acquit him, they did not permit him to return. And I think his work, it took him a while to get any kind of, it took him a while to get any kind of a real work permit there. When I went over there for the first time at the age of 12 in 1950, he was living there with my grandmother, and I was there in the same house, my grandmother's house. And he had been employed by the British, it was the British occupation zone where he lived at that time in northern Germany. And he had gotten some work for the British and possibly also with the Americans during the Berlin airlift time. And they needed translators anyway. And so he had gotten some work with the British as a translator. Uh-huh. And I think that's what he was doing at that time. Is that right? Would you?
Then he taught.
He later got a job teaching.
Teaching, yeah. I believe, English. Buhmann Schule in Hannover.
That was a business school, wasn't it? Yeah. So he did then get this job as an instructor, mm-hmm. and that was what he was doing when he was killed in a motorcycle accident uh-huh. in 1954, right? Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. Well, now tell me how your connection when you saw him when he was here. What was entailed in your visits here?
Well, I remember coming over on the ferry with my mother a couple of times. Mainly I remember the ferry trip, and then I remember that we were in one of the times we came, the time I remember best was for a Christmas party. And so I guess all families were invited to come and visit at that time. And we were in a great big room, and I don't know, I haven't had a chance to see the rooms where, or the buildings where they my uncle and the others who were kept here, detained, lived. I believe they were on the other side of the island where...
He wasn't physically ill, right? So he wouldn't have been in any of the hospital.
But no,
he was probably in the baggage and dormitory building, which I can point out to you. Is
that in this area?
Yeah,
because, see, this building looked very familiar to me in the outside of the main building. And I remember a very big room where this Christmas party took place, with lots of windows, and so it's kind of like the
Great
main
Hall? Mm-hmm.
right. And so it may have been in there. And I remember that there was a walkway all around it. And we went outside and, you know, walked around the walkway. I guess at that point they were, you know, they were being given the freedom of the island because they couldn't get off the island. There, so, and so I remember walking around the outskirts and talking with my uncle. And I remember coming in and there were Christmas songs that were being sung together and probably some kind of a meal and lots of people.
And what year would this have been? What
that
Christmas?
Was, I think it was 1943.
So the people who were here were mainly people actually waiting for deportation, I would think.
Yeah, they were, colleagues. I mean, people in similar circumstances to my uncle. And in this letter, the man who wrote the letter, who was also here with my uncle, and who apparently then ended up in Argentina because he wrote this letter from Argentina, he then mentions in the letter several people. He sort of says, so-and-so, you know, wrote a book, and so-and-so went to Bolivia and did this and that, and it's kind of a little discussion of some of the old friends that they had made while they were here together.
Well, what was your, can you remember your uncle's disposition? Was he, well, first of all, was he treated any better here than he had been, or do you know?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think it was much more pleasant for him here than wherever he had been before. And I remember him laughing about his books because he was an academic and an intellectual. He, when he was incarcerated before, I think they took everything away from him and he was not really permitted any reading material. And I know that once he was here, he was reading a lot and he kept asking my mother to bring him more books every time she came to visit him or we came. And I remember him showing us a couple of these books and laughing because the authorities here had torn the hard covers off. I think she brought him a copy of Anna Karenina. He'd asked for that. And they had torn the covers off the book because the hard covers could arguably be used as a weapon. And he was joking about that, you know. But he was a man who had this kind of mordant wit. I think he had a pretty philosophical outlook on the whole experience. He was certainly bitter in some ways, but he didn't really let it show. You know, he sort of had, and later when I spoke to him a little bit about it in 1950, when I was 12, he sort of looked upon it as, you know, you never can tell what kind of punches life is going to throw you. And they threw me some that were pretty bad. But you go on.
Yeah. Did you know of any ramifications of the internment that he bore as a result of it?
Well, certainly, I think he felt that it had destroyed his career, that, you know, that he would never, that what he had built up during the years that he was in this country was gone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it destroyed his marriage. It probably wasn't the only factor in the end of his marriage, because he was a man who was very attractive and had a lot of girlfriends during his marriage as well as thereafter. Mm-hmm. But I think he did feel that his life had been totally transformed, and that had this not happened to him, he would have gone on in his academic and his public career as a writer and a scholar, mm-hmm. which is how he saw himself.
I see. Was there anyone else in the family who was also arrested during this period that you know of?
In our family, I don't believe so. I know that my parents felt some repercussions.
Oh, how so?
Of him. Well, and when they arrested him and, you know, treated him as an alien agent and as a possible person who possibly was planning to organize a Nazi movement in this country, of course, they knew that his sister was here, or two sisters, actually, my mother. And then there was a younger sister who also was living in New York, who was the one that he then lived with when they released him from Ellis Island. And our family was living in Jamaica, in Queens, at the time. And we also had a house out on Long Island, in Bright Waters, Long Island. And the FBI came to our house and searched our house in Queens because my mother was the sister of this supposed enemy alien agent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I kind of remember them. You know, I remember somebody coming to the house and, you know, causing a lot of disruption. My mother had also neglected to become an American citizen. My father, fortunately, was smarter and was a citizen, but she was, so they came and searched our house, and they actually took, the only things that they found, I guess they thought she might be a spy or involved somehow in this, and so my sister can tell you more clearly, but I think my older brother had sent away for a toy telescope that you got in a Wheaties package. You know, you used to be able to save the box tops and send away. And I think a decoder ring. Mm. It was one of these rings, and you could, like, send little messages in code. And they actually confiscated these items as things that a spy could possibly use to send secret messages. And this has always been a family joke, you know, that, gosh, maybe we should go to the FBI and see if we can reclaim these items that they took. I mean, my brother was, and he was 10 or 11. My sister was just a year younger at the time. But my parents were certainly frightened by that.
Yes.
And my mother then immediately applied for citizenship during the war because they, you know, this was a traumatic experience for them. And then she was actually denied citizenship then, probably partly because of her association with our Uncle Fried, who was a really well-known person at the time. I mean, you know, so, and the other, my aunt, his younger sister, who was also in New York, she actually changed her name. Hmm. She was working in an office type job. She had jobs as a secretary. And she changed her name from Alhagen to Anderson legally at the time. And it was partly because of his notoriety.
Mm-hmm. Did they search her house too? Do you know?
I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. Although they may have questioned her. Unfortunately, this is a question we never thought to ask her. Mm-hmm. And she didn't really talk about it. I think it was an unpleasant experience for her, and she felt that she had to, she resented a little bit her brother that he, you know, kind of look at the trouble he's caused for the family by all of this carrying on.
Were you personally aware of anti-German sentiment at around the time of the war and thereafter?
I wasn't particularly, because I really wasn't I mean, when did I start school? I guess I must have started school during the war. I don't remember any, but I do know that my parents made a decision around 1940, around the time that this happened, maybe as a result of this search by the FBI, to speak English at home. And they had always spoken German. I mean, they were both German. And my older brother and sister grew up speaking German. And I really did not grow up speaking German because, you know, or up by the time I was 3 years old, they stopped and only spoke English in the home because they didn't want, I think my older brother and sister, and they'll be able to tell you if they come to talk to you, they did experience quite a bit of anti-German sentiment in school.
Uh-huh.
And that had made things a little tough for them.
Yeah. Maybe you could say a little bit about when your uncle was released from here and anything you know about that.
All right. I don't really know too much about it. Again, my sister will know a lot about that because I'm sure that he was released by 1946 because I don't know exactly when, because at that time my parents moved from Jamaica to New Hampshire. And they took me and my little brother, I had a baby brother, up to New Hampshire with him. And they must have left New York in the spring, March, April, something like that, because they bought a little summer resort on a lake in New Hampshire, and they wanted to get up there in time for the summer season, mm-hmm. which started in end of, you know, late June. But my sister and brother were going to high school in Jamaica. They were at Jamaica High. I think they were in their junior year or something like that. And so they didn't want to leave until the school year was over. So they stayed with our aunt in Manhattan and commuted to Jamaica High every day on the subway until school got out in June. And my sister was at my aunt's apartment. It was during that time that our Uncle Freet got out. And because they were living there together in the apartment, which was a very small apartment, it was like a one-room apartment. It was a big room, but it was just one room. Okay. So they had a sort of a dormitory there. And so my sister spent a lot of time there with our uncle. And so she knows a lot about what he was doing. I think he was pretty restricted because I think he was probably under orders. Maybe it was like a probation type mm-hmm. thing where he had to report to mm-hmm. someone every mm-hmm. week because he was not permitted to leave our aunt's apartment. I'm sure he would have preferred going someplace else. And because he had friends who lived in New York. And that probably would have been preferable to him to living in the same place with his niece, nephew, and sister, all in the same room. So
then he stayed there for a period, and then I guess he was free to go at some point?
Well, he was deported then.
He was deported from there.
Yeah, he was sent back to Germany, and yesterday when Margaret talked to his son said that he came back in 1947, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he must have stayed in New York for a period of months. It sounds like it must have been quite a while, 8 to 10 months. And I know he came back, though, in the winter, because I remember his telling me that he arrived in Hamburg, I think, or I think it was in Hamburg. And the woman whom he then married, he had already known her in this country before he was arrested. And she picked him up at the ship and then took him to her place. And it was a very, very harsh winter. And nobody had anything nobody had any coal, nobody had food. The conditions were particularly bad still. So I remember his telling me about that.
Hmm. Did he go back to the place in Germany that he had lived before he came to this country, do you know?
Well, he went, at some point, he married this woman, and then they moved into my grandmother's house, as I told you, which was in Celle, which is a small city near Hanover in northern Germany. Mm-hmm. And housing was extremely scarce because so many people had lost their houses in the bombing of all the cities. And also there were something like 15 million refugees that came from the eastern areas that were then controlled by the Russians and came into West Germany at that same time. So that it was, and my grandmother had a big house, our grandmother, in Celle. And she had always rented out the bottom floor and the family had lived in the top two floors of this house. But then at that time when he got there, the German government had taken over, they had, or maybe it was the occupation authorities still at the time, and had housed a lot of refugees in the house. So the owners of the house were permitted a very limited number of rooms. I think it was one room per person. So my grandmother could have one room and her younger son had one room. And then Uncle Fried, this uncle, and his wife. And she had a child, small child, by another earlier husband. They all lived in one room in this house. So it was a house where he had lived as a young man because he went to secondary school in that town, I believe. Uh-huh. He went to, he and my other uncles, Margaret's father, went to the gymnasium, it was called, which was the classical boys' high school in the town. So he did, in a sense, end up where he had started. Come from.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else you can think of that might be relevant to your uncle's experience or that you yourself witnessed or experienced when you visited that we maybe haven't covered? You can think of anything.
Offhand, I can't think of anything because my memories of being here are pretty limited.
Uh-huh. Well, you were young, and but it's very interesting about your uncle to have this on record, I think.
Yeah. And I think we can probably, find out a lot more now that we're kind of
started to
getting going in this. And apparently our cousin, his son, has shown quite a bit of interest in this. So,
good. Now, his son is here or his son is
no,
there?
No, his son is in Germany. Uh-huh. Both of his sons live in Germany.
I see. Well, maybe I'll talk with Marguerite and then we'll continue that way. Okay, this is Marguerite O'Hagan Monod Kelly, who is also a niece of Uncle Fried. Is that the way you...
Does Margaret have one of these? Does
no,
she need
I,
it?
In fact, I think maybe I'll switch
you
the
can
mic
just switch. Right.
To you to Marguerite. Okay, let's see. Why don't you just start, Marguerite, by saying your birth date and where you were born.
Mm-hmm. My birth date is the 4th of September, 1936, and I was born in a small village, Meinelsen, not far from Celle.
Oh, okay.
And after, usually in Germany you go to high school in grade after grade four, but I came to Celle in after grade six, and that's when I then also met Uncle Fried, I think, but maybe I visited my grandmother when I saw him for the first time.
And when you think about him, how do you remember him as a personality?
Well, my mother had four children and very little time to talk to her children because she had to see that there was food on the table. And since there was a large garden in this house, in this small town, that's where we were working, she or we. And it was just astounding to me that there was a man, an uncle, that very new to me, who would ask me to sit down on his sofa, or it was the sofa bed in this small room, which was very nicely put together, with lots of books, who asked me to sit down and talk with me. Nobody had ever done this in my life before, that I was handed a magazine. I don't know if I ever had a magazine in my hand before. It may have been Life magazine. It may have been. And, tried to tell me something about the United States and show me pictures in this magazine. And I remember this picture with many beautiful young girls on it. I assume it was the most beautiful woman. What is the contest?
Oh, the beauty contest?
Beauty contest.
Miss America.
Miss America.
So,
yeah.
So that is what I remember vividly. And I certainly was just very surprised that he wanted to talk to me.
Uh-huh.
And as you notice, my cousin asked him questions, though she's a year younger, but I was not used to asking questions. So she has told me that was very surprising for her when she came a year later. So I guess he just talked to me, and I did not ask many questions. So it was a more adult type of conversation that I had not experienced so far.
And did you continue speaking with him and having a relationship over a period of years?
I cannot say that because I was not living in that same house, and Heidi lived there for a while, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had to live with another family because in order to go to school, to a high school, I had to live with another family.
Mm-hmm.
And I may have visited him then again. I remember his marriage to Tante Johanna, his wife, because they were married at my father's church in Meinersen. So I just remember them walking in the snow, but mm-hmm. I did not have a conversation with him at the time. I then talked more to his wife when I visited.
Now, was he a religious man at all, or what religion was the family?
Well, my father's religion is Lutheran, like most people at that time or in that area are, when they are Protestants. And I don't remember my uncle being a church-going member. He may have been Lutheran by birth, but I guess my father asked them that they should be married in church, and so he saw to that.
Uh-huh.
That's why they came around Christmas time to be married in this small village.
I see. Mm-hmm. How about, I know you were taking some notes while we were talking. Are there mm-hmm. any things that we talked about that maybe you have some additional information that would be helpful mm-hmm. on our tape?
Well, my father was younger. I know, maybe 5 years younger or more. He was born in 1907, so you said he was born in
1899.
Okay, so my father is about 7.5 years younger, and he had to suffer from his older brother, who was much more outgoing, and my father was more withdrawn, I guess, as a kid. And they played tricks on him. There was another older brother, Hans, so those two ganged up against my brother. But I don't know if he wanted to talk about that. He also was a smart alecky, I think you say that in this country, in his school life. He had a problem with surprising his teachers.
Being a smart aleck. This is your uncle,
Fried. That's uh-huh. his uncle, Fried. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I can tell you more about his personality, too.
If we want that.
He sounds like an interesting, and I think if he was outspoken that way, that mm-hmm. would make it more likely that he would have been picked up and arrested.
He was very outspoken, and he was also very well-spoken.
Intelligent.
He was extremely articulate, and he was a a truly charismatic man. Hmm. You know, people just adored him. And children, too, as Margaret said, you know, he could relate to children, and you were immediately drawn to him, and he could joke with you and tell you stories and treat you as if you were really an interesting
person,
you know, valuable person whom he cared about. And but he did that this with all people. And he was extremely bright and precocious, and for that reason had a lot of trouble in the more authoritarian household that he grew up in, and in the education system that was very authoritarian.
Mm-hmm.
But he had many people in this country who were not disciples of his, but were very strong backers and admirers. And he really had a charismatic personality and a terrific sense of humor. And he was, as I say, he was also very egotistical, and you know, he felt the world revolved around him, basically, which is the way people who are like that often behave. So I don't want to.
Yeah.
But.
Okay. Well, one thing I sort of thought it was smart, if you can think and figure out things fast. For him, when he was sent into World War I, he knew what to do in order to protect himself. This is a story I believe related through my father, but I do not know exactly. But it certainly appealed to me that when these young students who at 16 or 17, they were told by, I think, their gym teacher or some teacher who was so patriotic to send a whole class going to the Western Front, which we know from some literature and also from history, without being prepared to fight. And the only thing he knew is when he heard this shooting going on, fall down, you do just throw yourself to the floor, and he was fast enough not to be hit. And he was the only one from this class that returned back to alive. So he then, after the war, did his, after World War I, did his Abitur. I mean, this is the final exam once you leave these gymnasiums or classical education school, you call mm-hmm. them. Okay.
Uh-huh. And then he came here shortly after that?
No,
he
first
stayed.
After that, there was a problem. What was he to do? He first had an agricultural stint and with some practicum at a farmer. His father put him there. I don't think he wanted to do that. And he didn't last very long in this environment. And then I guess started to study at the mining school in Clausthal, Zellerfeld.
Right. Mm-hmm. So our grandparents and thought that first our grandmother thought he should become a minister, because traditionally in her family the oldest son became a minister. But it was clear from relatively early on that this guy was not going to be cut out to be a man of the cloth, so they gave that up. And then they tried to think of things, you know, for him to do after the war, after he finished his high school diploma. And so I guess our grandfather thought that a mining engineer would be a good way to keep him busy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he always had a difficult relationship with his parents. They couldn't handle him. And so I'm sure that was one of the reasons why he decided to try his luck in this country.
Do you think it was solely his decision, and do you know what his bases were for coming to this country when he did?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure it was solely his decision. I think his parents probably would have been against that. I know that when my mother came, our grandmother was very much tried to prevent her in all sorts of extreme ways from leaving.
Uh-huh.
And
of course, on the other hand, they may have welcomed that he had a mission.
Well, they had a different attitude toward him. That's true. So they may have said, "Oh, thank God, he's finally gone out of our hair." And you said you thought that he had worked his way over as a
shipping coal. I remember
shoveling coal.
Yeah. He, in order to do something, my father helped him to give a speech in the small town which I mentioned before. And the same talk he also gave in other towns. And I believe seeing it once advertised in the town where I went to school, which was, in translation, from coal shoveling to being a professor at Columbia University. That was the title of the talk, or of this speech, Vortrag.
Yeah, speech.
Speech.
And this was before he came?
No, this was.
Oh,
this
we are now in 19. We are now in 1949.
I see. Uh-huh.
That is when he made these talks.
Oh, uh-huh.
So
these speeches gave these speeches.
And
he was very, very appealing in this small town. They were just that my father could have such an interesting brother, my mother was told afterwards. Yes.
Oh, your poor father.
Yeah. I mean, he was giving a sermon every Sunday, you know, but. You know,
so.
Your father became the minister.
Oh, it must have been in 1950 because he only came back in 49.
Uh-huh.
So it must have been 1950.
Your father came back.
My father came back from Russia in 1950, or shortly before 1950. So it must have been, this talk must have been given in 1950 or 1951.
Yeah, I see. Now, did anyone else in the family immigrate? First of all, his sister.
My mother.
Your mother, his younger
sister. Right, and she remained in this country.
And was he instrumental in bringing, he came first, is that the
yes,
way it went?
Yes, he came, I know that he was instrumental in getting my mother here. My mother was the next child, so she
Uncle
was.
Uncle Hunt.
Oh, that's right, there's Hunt, I'm sorry, she was the first girl, but so she was closer to him in age than the younger sister, obviously. And my mother was also, did not get along with her own mother too well, and our grandmother, had forced my mother to drop out of school after the 10th grade and become her assistant at home, help take care of the children and the household.
She was the oldest girl, your mother?
Uh-huh. And my mother was extremely unhappy with this setup. And then, actually, our grandfather had gone to Palestine. He was an agricultural economist and was an expert in farming, in the technology of farming and agronomy, I guess you'd call it. And he had been involved, he had a lot of friends who were Zionists, and after World War One, the European Zionists started going to
Palestine.
And probably beginning kibbutzes over there, so we think probably that's what our grandfather was doing there, because he went over there and he lived there for several years. And so my mother then, after her mother forced her to drop out of school, had complained to her father, and he had her come over to Palestine. So my mother had spent 2 years in Palestine with her father. And then he had gone back to Germany for a visit and died, had a heart attack at the age of 57 in Celle, and so suddenly died. And my mother came back from Palestine, and so then she was with her mother. And at that point, our Uncle Fried, who was in New York,
wrote to her and said, look, you can't stay in that hole anymore with this impossible mother of ours. Mm-hmm. And he sent her a ticket and said, get on the next boat and come on over here. And so he definitely had a direct mm-hmm. impact on mm-hmm. my mother's coming.
And then it was your mother who wrote the letters about his mistreatment in the camp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was pretty close to him. Mm-hmm. And they had, so they had also, from the time she came, which was about 1926, all the way through, she had seen him all the time. I mean, they did a lot of things together. Mm-hmm. They had many friends in common. Mm-hmm. When my parents had this little place on Long Island, our uncle would come out every weekend and play tennis and stay with them. So they had a very close relationship.
Did he treat you the way he did Marguerite?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Oh, very much so. And he, when I was in Germany when I was 12, now I was kind of lonely because my little brother was with her family in the country. And I was with this grandmother who spoke no English. I'd never been in this place. Life was pretty strange. And the Uncle Fried really took me under his wing. And I had always been a great reader from the time I was 4 years old. And all of a sudden I was over there and I didn't have any books that I could read because I could only read English. And he had English books, so he gave me... he gave me Gone with the Wind, so I read that, and some books by Aldous Huxley.
Oh, wow.
Gone with the Wind was, he only had two novels, because his books were more philosophy, psychology, political theory kind of books, which I wasn't really that interested in, but he had Gone with the Wind, and he had a book by Aldous Huxley called After Many a Summer Dies the Swan. I don't know.
Oh, I've heard of
it. You know that. Uh-huh. It's a pretty strange book. But so he gave me these books, and uh-huh. we used to have a lot of conversations. I mean, he knew that I was unhappy, and so he really took the time to spend some time. And I think he was interested in me because I was also interested in books and, you know, looked like I might become an intellectual at some point.
Well, you asked questions.
Yeah, right.
Poor Marguerite, he never learned to ask questions because it wasn't allowed, right?
it's true.
Yeah,
I can remember one of the first when I had just gotten over there in 1950, we were having dinner around mm-hmm. our grandmother's table, and your father was there.
No, you think so?
Okay. Yes, he was there. He had come for whatever reason, and mm-hmm. Uncle Hubert, and I don't know who else. And they were talking about politics and what was going on. And I remember I said, well, I think that Adenauer should do thus and so. And they all turned around and looked at me and like, what is this? You know, children should be seen and not heard. That was definitely our grandmother's mm-hmm. attitude, and probably your father's too, to some extent.
It changed when I was 14. But I did participate, but not at that time,
And also her father, as she said, had been, he was a prisoner of war in Russia for about 5 years, so he had been...
Yeah, at least 5 years,
yeah.
From 44 maybe to more. Nearly 50. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. my mother's conversation turned around nothing intellectual, though she was a well-educated woman. It's just too many worries, how to get to bring up these children and to be polite, and that is what the conversation was about. They were about table manners. Yeah.
Okay, well, we're right near the end mm-hmm. of the tape. Is there anything else that we haven't covered? Do you think your uncle made his peace with being back in Germany? I mean, did he? I guess he.
I think he did. I think that you know, when he finally got this teaching job, which was relatively close to the time that he died, actually. I think he hadn't had it very long. I think he finally kind of felt that he had turned the corner and that perhaps things were looking up in his life. I know that he harbored a deep sense of disappointment and kind of what if, because, you know, that was just a cataclysmic event. But I think I do think that he felt that he was on the way to making a meaningful new life instead of kind of just going around doing a little translating, a speech here, a speech there, and you know, thinking, what have I done with my life?
Okay. So, is there anything, Marguerite, you want to say in the end of the tape? About your uncle or your relation to him?
I hope that my cousin Heidi and together with his son, Hendrik, that they will write something together about him and his time in this country and Germany. So,
okay.
I'm very glad if I can be helpful.
Well, I thank you both for a very interesting interview, and maybe this will be the beginning of can be part of our collection here in the Oral History Archive. Okay, I've been speaking with Heidi Shirley and Marguerite Monod Kelly, who were speaking about their uncle who was interned here at Ellis Island. And this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service signing off.